Now in the case of United States against Woodard. Ms. Christensen.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent the appellate, Carol Woodard, in this case. I'm going to focus my arguments on the two competency issues. The government conceded the third issue of Pew, so we won't address that unless the court has questions. The competency of a defendant is not a mutable historical fact. It changes over time, particularly in someone who has a history of mental illness and mental disorders. The first issue is whether the district court should have ordered a second competency exam, in June of 2012, when Ms. Woodard had checked herself into a psychiatric program at a hospital in Indianapolis. The standard for ordering an exam is reasonable cause, and there is reasonable cause in this record for the district court should have ordered such an exam. Ms. Woodard displayed a continuing misunderstanding of her case in the legal process. She was fabricating oral orders of Judge Hamilton that simply do not exist in the record.
Well, the underlying question here is whether she was mentally incompetent or just being a pest, right?
Well,
and the district judge held a hearing and concluded that she was just trying to make a pest of herself.
I'm not
sure. Now, why are we supposed to second-guess that decision?
I don't think that's the district court's bottom line was that she was a pest. I think everybody agrees that she was mentally ill. There's no question of her malingering in this case at all. I think what happened that is error in the district court's judgment is that the district court became more concerned about the strength of the government's case over the passage of time than the defendant's competence to stand trial. And that is what trumped, in the end, the district court's decision. And that's never been an issue in competency evaluations or whether one should be ordered. The government cites the United States versus Chiappetta case for the idea that the court can consider the harm to the government's case by continued delays. Chiappetta was a different issue. Two points. One, Ms. Chiappetta was not mentally ill. She had been found competent. And at the time, the issue was not her mental competence. It was her mother's declining health and impending death. Ms. Woodard was mentally ill and actually continues to be mentally ill, but was particularly mentally ill at the time, rendering her incompetent to stand trial. Several doctors testified to that fact. There were two doctors that felt she was unable to leave the hospital at the time and would have filed an involuntary hold on her if she had tried to leave to comply with the district court's order to come to court. In addition to all of that evidence, the government did provide an expert who said that Ms. Woodard was competent to stand trial. This was based on a 2-year-old competency evaluation that had been ordered in 2010. And
Two full years.
When was the exam? It was ordered in, I believe, March of 2010. It was not done until the summer of 2010. The report was issued in September of 2010.
When was the hearing done on the report?
The hearing done on the report was in January of 2011.
I see.
And between those times, you start to see the competence even be questioned then. And at the hearing in January of 2011, Ms. Woodard is making indications that another competency exam is necessary. And I liken in my brief her competence as a boulder rolling down a hill. And as thinking about it, to me it's more a snowball rolling down a hill because it keeps gathering snow and trees and people and becoming a larger issue in this case until we get to June of 2012 and it comes to a head. And not only is the government increasingly justifiably frustrated, but Ms. Woodard's competence has continued to deteriorate to a point where she is no longer speaking to her attorney, where she is no longer listening to her attorney's advice. She's filing frivolous motions pro se. She is then, of course, voluntarily commits herself during the second and third week of June. The trial was eventually at that point moved a month later, and Ms. Woodard left the hospitalization program and went into a partial hospitalization program. She wasn't magically cured at that point. She was still suffering from a severe depressive disorder with psychotic tendencies and bipolar disorder. She went into a partial hospitalization program, which is basically a 9-to-5 hospital time, and you get to go home at night. And she was making progress, but at that point, a month later, her doctor said that he didn't feel she was competent to stand trial. She had had thoughts of harming her attorney. She was not working with her attorney, and not willing to work with her attorney at that time. The district court, the third motion for a competency examination was also denied. And this leads into our second issue. 2 days after that denial, on a Saturday after 4:30, Ms. Woodard pled guilty in front of a different judge, in a presumably empty courthouse, other than the people called in for this hearing particularly, 2 days before trial. And the government makes points that this is when she wanted to plead guilty. I am aware of no other case where a defendant pleads guilty on a Saturday evening in an otherwise closed federal courthouse, and all the other players come willingly to do so, unless there was a reason that's not in the record for doing that. Ms. Woodard made a sudden...
You had to get a spare judge, right?
That I believe... I don't know if that district does emergency judges or not. But
this was not the judge who was handling the
right.
case.
It was Judge Lawrence, and Judge McKinney was handling it.
Judge McKinney was away for the weekend.
Right. I believe so. And so Judge Lawrence handled it. And Judge Lawrence is a perfectly competent judge to handle change of plea hearings. However, there's no indication in the record that he read anything other than the indictment to the defendant at that hearing and the three plea documents that she filed, a factual basis, a declaration, and a plea agreement. There was no mention that they had just litigated her competence 2 days earlier. In fact, Judge Lawrence asked three questions about her competence. The first, whether she was on medications. The second, asking if they interfered, but not wanting to know what those medications were. And the third, whether those medications interfered with her understanding. For the third question, she had to be prompted by her attorney as to what the judge was asking. And her attorney said, "Do you understand what's going on here?" And she said, "I understand what's going on here." That was the extent of the judge's Rule 11 colloquy on competence. Competence and the knowing and voluntary nature of a guilty plea is one of the core concerns of Rule 11.
Now, the hearing on the competency had been what? There had been a hearing on whether to have a further competency hearing. exam. That terminated how many days before the plea?
Two. Okay. It happened on the 12th of July, and the plea was on the 14th. And again, then 2 days before trial was set to begin. Then there was a third hearing.
Judge McKinney.
Right.
Trial.
Judge McKinney did that.
He would have held the trial.
On the 12th. He did the motion for a competency hearing.
And then the plea was taken by Judge Lawrence. And
right.
But the trial was scheduled before Judge McKinney.
Yes. Judge McKinney, there's another complication, this fact that because Judge Hamilton actually started this case. But Judge McKinney had every hearing order for the rest of the case except for the change of plea hearing, and Judge Lawrence did that. And in an ordinary case, it may not be an issue that a different judge takes a change of plea hearing. However, in this case, it had been pending for 4 years and had been surrounded so much by Ms. Woodard's competency to not ask any further questions as to whether she understood what was going on and what the consequences of her guilty plea were. That's the error. That's what we are contesting here today and asking the court to reverse and remand on. I see I'm in my rebuttal time, and I will reserve the rest of my time.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Shepard.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it please the court, my name is Brad Shepard. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represent the government. What we have here, Your Honors, as I think is demonstrated by the record, This is a case where the defendant was going to do whatever she possibly could do not to go to trial.
Any finding on that by anybody?
In June of 2012, the district court, Judge McKinney, found finally that her motions, specifically I think he was referring to the latest motion to change counsel and motion to continue the trial, were not well-founded, not founded in fact, but rather only filed for the purpose of delay. So, yes, Your Honor, I believe based upon that, there was a finding that the defendant was engaging
in
gamesmanship.
And that was when, June?
That was in June of 2012. That was right before the first. I don't remember if it was a finding on the June 11th, which was the original date of the trial, or if it was a finding in the morning of June the 12th. It was in one of those two hearings where Judge McKinney made that finding. And then we had the preliminary hearing on the motion for the need for another competency exam in the afternoon of June the 12th. But it was in either the hearing on the 11th or the 12th where Judge McKinney made that finding, and I specifically referenced that in the briefs.
Now, Judge McKinney, 2 days before the plea hearing, when he finished hearing the evidence on whether there should be a second mental competency exam, did he actually rule?
I think Your Honor is confusing the two hearings that Judge McKinney held. The one that was before the plea hearing would have been almost the third motion for a competency hearing. That was a relatively short hearing. I think, and that was on July the 12th, and then the trial was for July the 14th. The bigger hearing was the June the 12th hearing, where the district court took evidence from the two psychiatrists and made specific findings as to what they said and ruled that a second competency hearing was not necessary. That in that hearing, the judge did make findings.
Third, right before they took the plea, did the judge rule?
Rule as to what, Your Honor? I guess I'm a little confused.
As to whether there was going to be any further inquiry into this person's mental competency.
Yes, he did, Your Honor. The judge denied the motion, ruled that there was not a need. He specifically referenced the fact that, as I brought up in my motions before the court in that, the statement by the defendant's treating physicians in the outpatient program were conclusory. There was nothing to back up their statement. Further, the judge noted that in the interim between the June 12th hearing and the July 12th hearing, there was a pretrial deposition, a Rule 17 deposition to preserve trial testimony. At that, the defendant appeared and assisted counsel during that. The judge noted in his ruling that, specifically, the defendant appeared and assisted her counsel. Based upon that, felt again that there was not a reason to have another competency hearing. And he could do that by telephone, as he was out of town at the time. Obviously, the two subsequent hearings required an in-person hearing. That was the detention motion of the government, and then ultimately the plea hearing itself, which required the judge. We don't call them emergency judges. We have just a duty judge, and they're on duty for the entire month. Judge Lawrence was the duty judge. He came in and he did the plea.
I remember they took the vice during the Nixon administration, they took the vice president's plea in the evening down in Virginia. And I know it's done, I can remember it being done in situations where defendant is also in the witness protection program. I've never seen a plea taken like this on Saturday evening sometime. I mean, sounds like there was a little bit of a bum's rush atmosphere to this thing.
I don't know that I would agree. As I made very apparent in the numerous filings that I put before the district court, due to the constant rescheduling of this trial, that there were a number of harms to the government. We had two witnesses who were professional psychologists. They constantly had to rearrange their calendars. We had a jury that had been called off. In fact, the first time, they were brought in Monday. They were brought in Tuesday before ultimately the trial was continued. They had to be called off. We were flying witnesses in, one from California.
I can understand those are all your concerns, but from the judge's point of view, should he take into consideration in ruling on this motion, deciding whether she's competent to take the plea, the harm to the government, as you've just described it?
I'm going to answer that in a yes and a no. The core thing the court has to decide, is the defendant competent to stand trial? That the government is not saying that there's anything else that needs to be here, and the standard is reasonable cause. I think that harm to the government can be viewed in that analysis when you're looking at what is the conduct of the defendant. So it's not so much the resulting harm to the government, but it's more what is the conduct of the defendant leading up to the questioning of the competency. And I think that is what the court is allowed to consider along with the entire record. And as we have here, I don't think when you view the changing in strategies, first moving for continuances, when that stopped to be effective, starting to use one's right to counsel as a shield, when that stopped being effective, to file a motion to proceed pro se, when the district court did not automatically grant a continuance but said, I'm going to set a Feretta hearing, to then check into the mental institution at Community North Hospital to misrepresent to the court that it was an involuntary commitment when, in fact, it was a voluntary, to check into a supposed emergency crisis with, as was noted in the medical records, which were before the court, 2 bags, 7 shirts, 2 cell phones, 1 laptop.
I read that. That cuts both ways, though. So that might support Ms. Christensen's point of view as well as yours. I'd be careful on that one.
But obviously, we think it goes that to what Dr. Detrana stated, and this is one place where I would disagree with the defense. I think Dr. Detrana, in essence, did state that the defendant was malingering. She specifically concluded there wasn't a psychiatric paranoia, that the only time she saw any sort of treatment was 2 days before trial. And I think we do have an opinion that she was malingering. Either way, the opinion of Dr. Detrana was before the district court. The prior opinion of Dr. Coons from 2010 was before the district court. The what can only be described as gamesmanship was before the district court. And further, the district court held an evidentiary hearing and personally examined the 2 psychiatrists before it made its decision. I don't think under any circumstances that can be called an abuse of discretion, which is the standard that we have here. The district court felt that Dr. Cunningham, and I think primarily based upon her final statement, stopped just short of stating that her paranoia was robbing her of making the choice to assist her counsel. And we see that in other instances, sovereign citizens, that I'm certain this court is well aware of, certainly the district courts are, they espouse ludicrous legal positions. They choose to believe things that everyone knows is not true, but they're competent. And they go to trial as such. They refuse to, I think I may be close to being up, but they refuse to help their attorneys, and they're always found competent. I think that's very analogous to what we have here. The record before the district court was that 2 psychiatrists said she's competent. She's just choosing not to help her counsel. One said the other way. You pair that with the entire record of what she was doing. His decision was not an abuse of counsel. As to the very briefly on the point of the knowing involuntary plea, the defense is focusing on one issue. It's a totality test, and included in the totality test are all the interactions that occurs before the district court and the defendant who is entering the plea. As I stated in the brief, there was a very lengthy colloquy between Judge Lawrence and the defendant. He read the indictment. He read all my time is up. If there's any questions, I can answer them. Otherwise, We would ask the court to affirm the conviction, and as we've conceded, Pugh, to remand for a resentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Christensen?
I'd like to address a few of the factual issues that came up. On page 20 to 23 of my opening brief, that's the district court's ruling on June 12th of 2012 regarding the second competency hearing request. And that's the ruling after Drs. Cunningham and Dutrana testified. Dutrana didn't say there wasn't a she didn't have a psychiatric issue. On page 19, I cite to Dutrana's testimony, she said she had a psychiatric diagnosis, but that did not make her incompetent, which is, of course, a standard. Many people have psychiatric diagnoses and are not incompetent. I would also point out that Ms. Woodard herself did not tell the court that it was an involuntary commitment. That came through a letter through her family members. And it's unclear through the process how voluntary it was, because the hospital would have put a psych hold on her if she had tried to leave AMA against medical advice. So finally, I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ms. Christensen. The case is taken under advisement.